cliffcentral.com.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with me, Kingsley Kipuri, on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Fantastic to be in the studio again. Firstly, apologies for the misfire last week. You may notice that we did not have a podcast up. We did do some recording, but we had some technical issues that made the actual listening experience quite painful to the ear, and we decided not to podcast that. Apologies for anyone who sort of tuned in live and had some issues with that. But we're back in studio. A massive thank you to Palesa and Greg on the technical side of Cliff Central for making sure that we're good to go this week. Now to jump right in. This week, we're going to be looking at matters continental, looking at Chad, looking at Zambia, looking at Uganda. So I'll give you a quick run through of what to expect. Firstly, we'll be talking about something that's playing out in Uganda, where prominent activist Stella Nyanzi has been arrested for insulting remarks she made against the president, and we'll be speaking a bit about that and what seems to be quite sort of anti-democratic, anti-freedom of speech sort of regime actions in Uganda. Secondly, we'll speak a bit about the extraordinary African Chambers court in Senegal that's made a massive judgment on an appeal against former Chadian president Hissène Habré, and we'll be speaking to Amnesty International a bit about that in a second. And lastly, we'll be speaking to Simon Allison, who you'll remember as a sort of frequent guest on here, and we'll be speaking to him about what's happening in Zambia between the president, Mr. Edgar Lungu, and the opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, and what's also being seen as very anti-democratic, so I suppose a very sort of depressing show for those interested in democracy and governance and so on. For those tuning in, so basically, just to give a quick background of what's happened, we had a hybrid court. That's the Extraordinary African Chambers that was actually set up in Senegal, not Chad. And what that court did was sort of a set up hybrid court that was set up to prosecute former Chadian president who was reigning from, or was the president from 1982 to 1990, and was charged with war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture, with a sentence of life imprisonment. And this was last year. He was not found guilty on charges of rape, which was also another charge put forward, but was found guilty on all the others, and the sentence was life imprisonment. Now, this is absolutely massive, because this is a former head of state, right? And you have a hybrid court set up. So you can imagine how sort of important that is for people who are sort of watching, you know, democracy and governance issues across the continent. So that was set up, and last year in May was found guilty of those charges. So there was an appeal process where the former president, he sort of appealed and said, no, this is, you know, should not be how it should be. And from that, the Extraordinary African Chambers Court sort of upheld its ruling and continued with that. So I'd say, I mean, why is this so important? Why is this something we're watching? I'd say, firstly, the idea that a special court and a hybrid court was set up in a different country other than the country where the actions were committed. I think that's massive. These were committed in Chad. This was done in Senegal. So what this means, if you have an Omar al-Bashir or, a Nkurunziza or somebody who's being... And those are, you know, Sudan and Rwanda. If you have somebody in a specific country, even if they're head of state and they are found sort of answerable for issues around crimes against humanity, even after they're no longer president, that means other countries can step in and say, we are going to set up this special hybrid situation and charge you. And that's absolutely massive, because we've seen the shortcomings of people in their own countries, or rather judicial systems in specific countries, being able to hold former heads of state accountable for their actions. I mean, even current heads of state. I mean, you'll remember Kenya after the post-election violence when former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan stepped in, and the first step was to say, okay, you know, Chief Justice in Kenya and local courts, you have X amount of time to build a case, to form a case, because ideally you want these things to be handled internally. And they were just not able to do it. It's very difficult in terms of political will and conflicts of interest for existing judicial systems, some people who are elected by the same president, to act against the same person or the former person. So I'd say the fact that this is being done in another country is absolutely massive. Secondly, is it answers a big issue that we've had about the ICC. You'll remember, or you'll recall, if you've been listening to the show, that the International Criminal Court has come under a lot of fire continentally. Number one, it's very resource intensive. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars to run. And we've only had, one or two prosecutions. Secondly, is there's this whole idea or this element that it's anti-Africa or it's racist. I mean, this has been discussed a lot of times, this idea that only Africans are charged and only African presidents and only African former heads of state are charged. And I believe what this does, this idea that you can set up a hybrid court with other countries locally, is it removes that whole stumbling block of the ICC set up by foreign powers, and it allows us to be able to jump that whole legal issue of saying, oh, but it's ICC is funded by foreign powers, it's another form of colonialism, we can avoid that altogether. Between the African Union and local countries and local courts, we can go around all that and simply set up our own courts. I mean, of course, there are a lot of legal obstacles, and there's now regional politics at play. Are neighboring countries, are other countries willing to get involved? Is there the money and the political will at the African Union level to want to get involved? So there are numerous other questions, but I think this is an extremely, extremely important precedent. We won't be able to speak to Gaetan from Amnesty. We'll move to Simon Allison, who will try and get on Skype. I think Palesa's working on if we can just switch Simon Allison to Skype, not telephone. I think it's just really important to hit home of just how important this is. The idea that an extraordinary African Chambers Court can be set up in a different country, that's Senegal, not Chad, to try a former head of state. Right? This is somebody who was in power for 8 years, was accused of killing and torturing, you know, tens of thousands of people, accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture, and can be sentenced to life by the special court. He can appeal, and that can be held up. I think that's absolutely massive, and I'd love to, and we'll be speaking to Simon shortly, and I'm sure he'd have something to say on this. It would be really interesting if we could find out what this means for people like Omar al-Bashir, for people like Pierre Nkurunziza, for people even like President Moi of Kenya and former maybe even apartheid presidents. It'd be really interesting to see what happens and how we can go back into crimes previously committed to say, hey, these things can still be brought up. Next, we're going to be chatting to Simon Allison via Skype very shortly about what's happening in Zambia. So we have former President Edgar Lungu, and after an election last year that he's declaring as having won, there was massive, massive, massive allegations that was not a free and fair election. And I believe we have Simon Allison on the line. Simon, can you hear us?
I'm with you, Kingsley.
Okay, wonderful. Simon, you know, in some movements and collections, deserters at risk of being threatened to death. So it's really interesting that we are still on speaking terms. I suppose Daily Maverick is more civilized than those other movements, I suppose.
That is fighting talk, but I like to believe we're all part of the same broader movement, fighting for the same things.
Absolutely. For those tuning in who don't know what we're talking about, Simon has started a fantastic new job as Africa editor at Mail and Guardian. So I suppose we're rivals now, but also friends. Simon, congratulations and thanks for still making time for us.
Thanks, Kingsley. I've always got time for you.
Okay, fantastic.
You know that.
Now to get started, a country we don't talk too much about on the show is Zambia. Generally assumed to be quietly chugging along, a model for governance and democracy, but some really, really worrying, you know, stories and news coming out of there. A lot of them, actually, I believe, pushed by you. So, Simon, how have we gotten to a point where the president has orchestrated it such that the opposition leader is being charged with treason? How on earth did we get here?
You know, it's always a good sign when a country is not talked about on the Daily Maverick show. It means things are going well. But Zambia has been exhibiting dangerous signs for a while now, ever since the last election, which was very much disputed between the ruling party that won it and Hakainde Hichilema's party, the main opposition leader. Hichilema still says that that election was not fair. And look, what we do know is that there were problems with that election. We don't know what the impact of those problems would have been. So it's impossible to say that Hichilema would have won in a free and fair election. But we do know that there were problems. Now, fast forward a few months, and Hichilema is in his house in the middle of the night, and suddenly this huge team of police, the estimates range from about 100 to 300 policemen, all wearing balaclavas, which is a very strange operating procedure, storm into his house, bang down the door. He retreats into a safe room. They throw toxic, some kind of tear gas into the house, trying to almost smoke him out. They apparently, allegedly, torture and assault some of the workers that lived on the property. Him and his family managed to get into this special safe room. I actually spoke to them while they were, Mr. Hichilema while he was in the safe room, and I've never heard a man sound more terrified on the phone. I think he really thought that they were coming to kill him that night. Eventually, you know, in the morning, his lawyers managed to come to the property. They made a deal with the police. They coaxed him out of the safe room. He's now sitting in jail in Lusaka on these, frankly, ridiculous treason charges. He is being accused of according himself the status of the president by impeding the president's motorcade at a cultural ceremony. And this really is a traffic incident between, you know, the opposition leader's convoy of vehicles and the president's official convoy of vehicles. You know, they were trying to share the same space of road, and it got a little bit messy. The president had to wait a while. The president seemingly is so incensed by this that he thinks it's a crime against the country.
I mean, this sounds like a very, shall we say, vulnerable person who would take something like, you know, you decide was a traffic incident, and take this that seriously. Is this a president who's perhaps terrified that after the disputed election that, you know, that his position is at risk in any way?
Kingsley, that's spot on. I was in Lusaka last week and I spoke to a lot of activists and politicians and civil society people, and two adjectives kept coming up when they were speaking about the president. The first adjective was insecure. The guy knows that his election victory was not above board. He knows that there is a chance that the opposition is actually more popular than him. And this is driving a lot of his paranoia and a lot of his actions against civil society, against media, and against opposition parties, because of course it's not just about Hakainde Hichilema himself. It's a much more wider attack on political space and freedom of expression. The second adjective which I enjoyed was incompetent. the sort of prevailing view was he's not very good at being a would-be dictator, you know, and this treason charge is a great example. You know, I'm sure with a little bit of thought, the president and his lawyers could have come up with something vaguely believable that they could use to charge Hichilema with. But this traffic incident, this battle of the motorcades is just so absurd that it makes the whole thing so blatantly, obviously a political ploy. And we can all see through that. And that is also mirrored in you know, other ways in which he's trying to control civil society. You know, unlike Zimbabwe, which has been doing this for decades, Zimbabwe has one of the best intelligence organizations on the continent, if not the world. Zambia doesn't. They don't have the spooks you need to run a dictatorship. They don't have the kind of intense security forces you need to run a dictatorship. So as much as people are worried about Zambia backsliding, they also don't think that President Lungu has the competence to pull it off.
And I'm not sure whether it's an insult or sort of a great relief that we have somebody who's not competent enough to be a real dictator. I mean, Simon, so what happens now? Because I believe there's no bail on treason charges, so Mr. Hichilema is still in jail, and I also assume elections wouldn't be for another 4 or 5 years. So, you know, do we continue with a insecure president who's I assume will continue to impede any opposition and media freedoms and so on, and opposition leaders who are in danger of being thrown in jail without bail at any time?
Look, there is a lot of talk in Lusaka about how now is the time for more active resistance. And I've even heard, you know, in very whispered conversations about the possibility of some kind of armed resistance. I think that this is a huge over-dramatization of the situation. You know, we're not nearly at the point of civil war yet. There's a long road still to be gone down in terms of legal challenges, in terms of electoral challenges, and in terms of possibly even parliamentary challenges. You know, there are a lot of avenues that Zambia still has to explore in terms of preventing President Lungu from going down the authoritarian path, if that indeed is where he wants to go. Mm. So I think that what we are going to see is a lot more contentious politics in Zambia, a lot of stuff going through the courts backwards and forwards, a lot of outraged statements from various people, but really the crunch time is going to be the next election, and that's what the opposition will be building towards. And, you know, they may even use Hichilema's arrest as a rallying cry. In fact, they will, certainly. Definitely. Yeah. They'll turn him into a martyr figure, and it might actually help them.
Might end up being great news for the opposition. Now, Simon, bringing South Africa into the fold, I think we spoke informally about this, and you say that sort of our domestic issues here with the ANC and President Zuma and so on have compromised our sort of moral high ground in situations like this across the continent. Could you just speak a bit more about that?
Absolutely. South Africa has an unparalleled position within Southern Africa. You know, we are the dominant superpower by far. We are the hegemon. We are the economic power as well. You know, our South African businesses are huge in almost every Southern African country. We are in a position to exert serious influence in Southern African capitals, and we do. Often it's quiet, you know, Thabo Mbeki's famous quiet diplomacy. But it is there. And what it sort of does is we all our diplomacy is sort of geared towards preserving the status quo, because we want, you know, markets to access and we want things to remain very stable. Mm-hmm. Any kind of conflict threatens that. And I think that if South Africa were to really get on President Lungu's case about what he's been doing recently, there would be a reaction. There would have to be a reaction, because South Africa is so important. But South Africa has been silent, deathly silent. We haven't said a word. And I think that is partly because the president is so, you know, he's so distracted by, the president of South Africa is so distracted by his own domestic issues, but partly because those same domestic issues, you know, the allegations of corruption, the patronage, that are swirling around President Zuma, kind of mean he can't go around criticizing other Southern African presidents for trying to do the same thing. Mm. You know, while I was researching the treason charge against Hichilema, I suddenly remembered that a treason charge had been brought against Julius Malema last year by the African National Congress. So, you know, in some ways, Zambia is just mirroring the tactics used by the ANC here.
And Simon, what about the African Union? I know this is something I come to a lot. Every time we talk to you, I'm always like, what is the African Union doing on this? Is it necessary? Perhaps is this a domestic issue and it's actually best that, you know, Zambia as a democracy figures it out? Or is this the kind of incident where we expect the AU to either publicly or quietly sort of step in and say, hey, what's going on here?
Well, Kingsley, I think you've pretty much answered your own question there. Yes, on the one hand, this is a domestic incident, and the African Union doesn't like to intervene, and that is definitely the message that is coming informally out of Addis Ababa, informally, because we haven't heard anything official from the African Union, not from its new chairperson, Moussa Faki, not from the Peace and Security Council Commission. On the other hand, the African Union preaches this doctrine of early warning, of conflict prevention, of stopping situations from spiraling out of control before they spiral out of control. And I think Zambia is a perfect example of where you want them to be more active. Now, I don't think Zambia is going to spiral out of control and turn into civil war. But you know what? We don't know for sure. And there are lots of very ominous mutterings coming from people. Surely this is where the African Union should be stepping in and saying, hey, Zambia, you are violating democratic norms. You're violating continental norms, the policies we have established, and you know, some kind of rap on the knuckles. But nothing has been forthcoming. And this sort of combination of silence from the African Union, silence from South Africa, silence from the rest of the continent, can only encourage President Lungu. He's, you know, he's taken a step over the democratic line. He's dipping his toes in the waters of authoritarianism, and he's finding that those waters are actually quite friendly. There's no backlash whatsoever.
Incredibly, incredibly worrying. Simon, before I let you go, I want to take you to West Africa, and I say this completely owning that we didn't prepare to talk about this at all. So to give you some context, we were speaking a bit about the Extraordinary African Chambers Court in Senegal that upheld their judgment on former Chadian president Hissène Habré, and was supposed to speak to someone from Amnesty International who we weren't able to reach in the end. So I gave a really, you know, I'm sure shallow and poor monologue about that, and I am incredibly excited about this idea of hybrid courts and solving matters regionally and continentally. And I'm sure I left the other piece of the puzzle out, which is why this is difficult and perhaps is not going to keep happening anytime we have challenges like this. Are you able to say anything about you know, hybrid courts like the one we just saw coming out of West Africa, and whether that could perhaps be the solution to some of the issues we've had in the ICC across the continent?
Look, the hybrid court in Senegal that tried Habré was a massive success. It really was a fantastic example of how these things can work. But let's not forget how difficult it was to achieve this success. You know, Habré lived in Senegal for, I think it was more than two decades, pretty much untouched, having a lovely life in a beautiful villa on the seaside before anyone could get to him. It really took an incredibly concerted effort from international civil society, and particularly Human Rights Watch. I think it was Human Rights Watch. Reed Brody, a researcher for Human Rights Watch, really tenaciously pursued this. He got victims groups together. He collected evidence. So it was a really difficult, long, drawn-out process that may or may not have worked. At any point in the process, there were these obstacles to overcome. And look, the only reason why it did work in the end is because there was a huge political change in Senegal itself when Abdoulaye Wade, the president, was unseated in a really surprising election by Macky Sall, who was much more progressive than Wade was. So, you know, the hybrid court, while being a good idea, is so precarious. It relies on a whole bunch of things going according to plan and not being messed up. There's no certainty that it will work. And I think that's what the ICC was trying to bring, was kind of trying to formalize this process under one roof and make it reliable. Because, you know, justice, to be justice, you need to know it's there. Yeah. You can't just maybe have justice, maybe not, depending on various sets of circumstances. You need to know that if you do commit the crime, there is something that is going to come after you. And I think that was really the foundation of the ICC, was that we can't just do this ad hoc anymore. But having said that, given all the problems that the ICC has been experiencing in Africa, hybrid courts are our next best solution. There isn't going to be an African version of the ICC anytime soon, the sort of African Court on People and Human Rights. That's just a pie in the sky, not going to happen for various reasons that we can talk about later. Yeah. So we're kind of left with hybrid courts as plan B, and it's a decent plan B.
Simon, that was fantastic. I should have just called you, you know, an hour ago and just gone through all of that. Simon, thank you so much. Thanks for chatting to us, and I'm sure we'll keep coming to you long into the future.
Thanks, King. Okay. Please do. I don't want to be excommunicated now I'm on the other team.
I mean, we only lasted one day in our efforts to sort of, what's the word, to ignore you and blacklist you. So clearly, you know, not going to happen. Wonderful. Thanks for chatting to us, man.
Cheers. Always a pleasure. Okay.
For those tuning in, that's Simon Allison, who's the Africa editor at the Mail and Guardian now, former Daily Maverick journalist. So please make sure to grab the Mail and Guardian too, and you know, and follow some of the important work they're doing. Not in place of us, of course, but together with, we can be, you know, competitors and friends all at the same time. It was really great to get some more context on the court that I was so excited about, the hybrid court that came out of Senegal, and whether and the exciting opportunities that presents for the rest of the continent, as well as the challenges. You don't want to have a crime committed and then have to have, you know, a perfect alignment of political actors, and then only then do you have sort of a court in place to step in. Okay, now turning to another part of the continent. We've covered SADC and West, and now looking towards the East. We'll be talking a bit about somebody called Stella Nyanzi, who's an activist who comes out of East African country of Uganda, who's been arrested on charges that we'll dip into just now, and it's really a sort of a interesting entry point to look at matters of gender, matters of sort of public intellectualism in Uganda, matters of freedom of speech. In the scope of a over 30-year reign of one president, Yoweri Museveni. So we'll be speaking to Bwesige Mwesigire, who's a writer, an academic, and a lawyer. Bwesige, we should have you on the line now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks for joining us, Bwesige. Now to just jump right in, we've been hearing a lot about this person called Stella Nyanzi and why this person has now captured the attention of the Ugandan state and is now in prison. And I'd love if you could just give us some background. Who is Stella Nyanzi and why was this person arrested?
So Stella Nyanzi is a PhD scholar. She's working with Kerry Institute of Social Research. So the first time people started learning of her was last year when she was protesting the closure of her office by Professor Mahmoud Mamdani, who is more famous. So she protested by undressing up to her knickers to put attention to the fact that she was being oppressed at her workplace. And since then, she was suspended at the university for her protest, and she started critiquing the Museveni regime on Facebook using particularly erotic images, one of them saying that the president was sodomizing Uganda, and which attracted a lot of attention, but also a lot of criticism from this largely conservative society. And so recently, early this year, Museveni gave a speech to celebrate the end of the 31st year of his rebel army taking power in Kampala. And in that speech, he said that he's not a servant of anybody. And then in reaction to that speech, Stella Nyanzi wrote that, or what the president was saying was nonsense, that the language he was saying, was speaking, is a language of buttocks. So he's a pair of buttocks.
Okay.
Then after that, that didn't attract, at least we didn't see immediate attention. After that, the president's wife, who is also the Minister of Education, announced that the government was not going to provide sanitary pads anymore, which was an electoral promise that was made in 2015. And then Stella again commented on that, saying that the First Lady, which is a title that we use for the president's wife, but should just say the wife of the president, or the Minister of Education, is not Stella's mother, is not a mother to anyone if she doesn't feel the pain of young girls who feel embarrassed and sometimes don't go to school during their menstruation because they don't have sanitary pads. And this is a promise they had made. And that attracted attention, at least publicly, from the police, from the security services, and Stella. Following that comment, Stella was invited to the police. She was stopped from traveling outside the country, and she was eventually abducted. And then when she was presented in court, she was charged with offending the president under the Computer Misuse Act. And then the state made an application for her to be taken for a mental health examination to ascertain if she's of sound mind. And so the defense couldn't ask for bail until this application is disposed of. And that's where we are now. It's almost a month since she was taken into prison.
Now, Bwesige, I mean, a lot of this, I mean, you know, forgive me, perhaps the international perspective that makes it, you know, sound less, but a lot of this sounds uneventful. Like, you know, I could go on and call the president whatever I wanted. Why does one person going on Facebook and saying, despite the colorful language, insulting the president, why would that catch the attention of the president? Why is that worth
because our president, as I've said, our president has been in power for the last 31 years. So the levels of power that he holds are different. So there is people like me. I was born in 1987, and this man took power in 1986.
Yeah.
So he's not just a president. He's more than a president. And he's, so there is this invisibility about him. So when someone reduces him to a human being and says, you're a pair of buttocks, because the level of fear in the country is so much that even before the state picked interest, or the state showed that it had picked interest, people were worried for Stella. So people are saying, oh, we're collecting money for bail, because that's the level of repression in the country, that you have a dictator, basically, someone who's been in power for so long, and someone who behaves as if he's beyond the law, because the law is him and he is the law, and so you can't insult him. So what other people might think, this is normal, and I've seen in South Africa, for example, people using colorful language to talk about President Zuma. But in Uganda, because one, there is the fact that this is a conservative society, but also the fact that this man has dominated our life, whether political, social, cultural, even religious life.
Now, Wasiki, when I look at this, you know, a lot of people, I suppose, it's easy to dismiss as, you know, somebody just, you know, perhaps out of rage, you know, using the buttocks, and even, you know, previously stripping naked in her activism at the university. But some people have written that there's actually precedent for this in the form of something called radical rudeness. Could you speak about a bit about what this idea, ideology is, and some of its history of use in Uganda?
So in the 1940s, when Uganda was still a colony, a protectorate of the British government, there were these, of course, one of the things that the British used was indirect rule. So they used the kingdom, Buganda Kingdom, the kingdom after which the country is named, and their officials to rule over the country. So the activism, the anti-colonial activism in Uganda, was against British officials, but also against native officials who were working on behalf of the British. And so there was these particular activists who were tired of the formal polite ways in which independence was being sought. So whenever there would be agitation for independence, people would be called in to have dinners and things like that, and then the agitation would calm down. So there are these people who were tired of that nonsense. And so one of these invitations, one of the activists responded, and in his 18-page response detailed the vulgarities of colonial leadership. So said, I'm not going to come because what you've been doing to us is immoral, that colonialism is basically foul. This is not something that we're interested in, and this polite behavior that you keep enforcing onto us is not something that is a form of oppression, basically. And these petitions were banned. These letters, these open letters he was writing, were banned, and so they used to circulate illegally. So in a way, language has been a ground for colonial oppression, and of course, even with the post-colonial dispensation, the fact that Uganda got independence does not necessarily mean that the society was decolonized. So to date, to speak in a certain way is still considered immoral, is still considered bad manners. So for a person like Stella Nyanzi to do the things that she's been doing, to call things by their names as opposed to euphemizing them, is something that is radical. But also, Stella Nyanzi is a twin mother, which in Luganda has a specific title of Nalongo. And according to Uganda tradition, a twin mother has the prerogative to use any language she wants to use. So whereas other normal people who are not twin mothers cannot, for example, say the words that refer to genitals, a twin mother can do that because that's the cultural prerogative they have. And Stella has always referred to the fact that she's a twin mother and she has a right to use this particular language.
I mean, I hear you, and I can just imagine in a conservative society where you have a, you know, sort of semi all powerful, perceived as invincible dictator, you know, to talk about things like sodomy and to describe the person as buttocks, there's a there's a disarming. I can feel sort of a disarming feeling of somebody pretending or idealizing themselves as all powerful, only to be reduced by something as simple as words. So I can definitely see something in there. Now, Bosiki, just to the next point, this, as you mentioned, started also to do with sanitary pads. It's something Stella's passionate about, and the minister in charge of this, who's also the first lady, was the person in charge of implementing this, and the campaign promise has been broken. It's also been reported that the government has since scrapped a tax on sanitary pads. Is that true? One, and two, should we see that as a really encouraging sign of activism working?
Yeah. So what happened is, when Stella was invited to come to the police, someone on her social media commented that maybe to show them that we are angry as citizens, we should start a campaign to provide the pads, since they are not providing the pads anymore.
Also a private effort to provide those.
Yeah, that's how the campaign started. Okay. So the campaign started by Stella saying, come to the police station with me and come with the pads. And then after that, they started getting pads from people. The promise to cut down tax on pads, as Stella had written before she was taken in prison, is a lie, basically. Okay. Because one... there's still next month is when the budget will be read, and a lot of the things have pretty much been done. But two, the children, the girls that the pads are being distributed to, or the girls that need the pads, still won't afford the pads. So reducing the tax won't make the pads accessible or affordable. And this has also been part of the campaign, that it's not just girls not having pads that are made a certain way. It's sort of a class oppression, right? Because these are only the poor who cannot afford the pads. So, and a lot of the statistics show that girls who go to rural schools and urban schools that are located in poor localities do not perform well. So there is a gender dimension to it. There's also a class dimension to it. And of course, Stella is a middle-class woman, but to also raise the consciousness of middle-class Ugandans, to say, you have it going well for you, your children can afford this, but there are girls who can't afford this. And this is why we should raise money for these people who can't afford this. And now, again, after Stella was taken in prison, the ministry, again, the same woman, Mrs. Museveni, then said, that one, they are not sure of the quality of the pads that are being delivered, and these pads are being bought from shops. So you would imagine that the Uganda National Bureau of Standards has already stamped approval on these pads. But also to say that secondary school and primary school administrators should not allow these citizens to distribute the pads. So now the poor girls cannot have pads from government, and now the same government is saying they can't have pads from well-wishers, which really goes back to the egocentric nature of this fight.
Yeah.
That here you have people who are drunk on power and do not want to be challenged in any way. Even if the poor are going to suffer for it, just don't challenge them, basically.
And absolutely. And basically, could you just contextualize this for us in the scope of sort of the sort of wider politics in Uganda? Do you see this as potentially being a turning point in terms of either public intellectuals or the wider country saying, you know what, this is enough. People are being jailed for no reason. The sanitary pads issues is a mess. We can't even say things on Facebook. Or do you see this really as just business as usual? It's another person who spoke out, another person in jail, and, you know, the Museveni sort of dictatorial regime continues as usual.
I think it depends on how they will handle it, right? So after arresting Stella Nyanzi, a journalist with the Nation TV, one of the independent television stations, was abducted because she posted a blog that said that all of our citizens should rise up. It shouldn't just be a Stella Nyanzi issue, because we have so many grievances. And then she was abducted and taken around the city for about 6 hours and then released the next day. And she had been wound and her hair had been cut. So it is clear that the regime is scared, that people might no longer fear them. Now they have been rendered susceptible to criticism and attack. But also, it depends on, I think what they're trying to do is to show us that, look, we're still powerful, so we still can take you to prison, we still can abduct you, we still can harm you physically, and so that people can continue to fear. And last year, November last year, there was a massacre in the western part of the country, a massacre committed by the National Army against loyalists to a kingdom. So in this district, the National Resistance Movement, which is the ruling party, lost all parliamentary seats. They lost all, so they lost elections badly. And there was that massacre. Over 100 people were killed by the National Army. So there is this crude and very repressive and brutal response that we are getting from the state to anyone who dares to critique them. I think there are only two ways about it. One is that whoever is going to critique them is going to be ready for the results. So this has a potential effect of radicalizing dissent, because now you know what is coming for you, right? There could be a massacre, or be taken to prison, or you could be abducted, or you could be shot, right? So now it means that whoever is going to oppose is going to be ready for the worst, which I don't think is something they want, because we may have uglier situations coming. Or it could mean that people will be scared and nothing will happen. So we don't know where it will go, and we are waiting to see. As of now, almost a month since Stella was taken in, we've not seen an uprising, but we don't know where it will go.
And lastly, probably, you know, very similar question to the one is previously a lot of the sort of violence from the president was targeted at sort of opposition parties, specifically Kizza Besigye, who was often in the news as a victim of, you know, his of presidential forces based on his opposition to the government. Now you've mentioned a journalist. Now you've mentioned Stella, who's an activist and an academic. Could this potentially have the effect of sort of galvanizing a united opposition from civil society, not opposition politically, but opposition to anti-democratic behavior across perhaps civil society and journalism and academia? Is that something that's a potential way this could play out, or is it really just up in the air, as you said?
That's true. Even before Stella was taken in, one of the things she kept saying is, I'm opposed to the repression, but I'm not necessarily a member of an opposition party. So previously, politics has been between the opposition and the government, right? And now we're seeing that it's not just the opposition, right? And because of the politics of the opposition, not everyone who is opposed to the dictatorship is necessarily affiliated with the opposition parties. So you're right that one of the things that is happening is that you have a civil society, in the true sense of the word, that is rising against Museveni, something that he doesn't know how to deal with, obviously, seeing how he has dealt with the Stella case.
Absolutely. Well, Sigye, thanks so much for chatting to us. It's something we'll definitely continue to watch, and we hope that there is a way to have a more sort of democratic country without any form of you know, widespread violence or anything of the sort. So thanks so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. That's Bwesigye Bwamwesigye, who's a writer, academic, and lawyer. Done some great work out of Uganda. Also did some work at Makerere University, where Stella Nyanzi formerly also worked. So really, really great sort of on-the-ground voice on matters such as this. Unfortunately, that's all we have lined up. Thank you so much for chatting to us. We spoke to Bwesigye Bwamwesigye. We spoke to Simon Allison. It's just a mixed bag, really, in terms of, you know, how I feel after covering issues like this. You have really great news coming out of Chad and Senegal, where a former president can be held accountable for really heinous acts and really criminal acts, really. And we still have a long way to go in other areas, where we see President Lungu in Zambia and now, you know, Museveni in Uganda. But we forge on and really hope that if we continue to shed light on matters of governance and matters of democracy, that we can ensure that even where, you know, countries and people fall short, that there's room for civil society, for the media, for governance structures locally and continental to step in and make sure that there's consequences for when people do things like this, for when you kill people, for when you jail people without reason, for when you're anti-democratic and clamping down on media freedoms and so on, that there's consequences. And I think that's really the first step for having sort of a free and more democratic continent. Thank you so much for tuning in across the country, across the world. It's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.